Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 24th of May, these are our main stories. The most senior US public health official issues a stark warning that children and teenagers could be at profound risk of harm from social media use. Washington has promised nearly $250 million in aid for refugees fleeing the fighting in Sudan. And Brazil's Minister of Racial Equality wants a full investigation into racism in Spanish football after the striker Vinicius Junior was the target of racist abuse. Also in this podcast, a watch that belonged to the last Chinese emperor has sold at auction in Hong Kong for more than $5 million.
The highest result for any wristwatch belonged to an emperor, and it is the highest result for any watches that Philips Asia ever sold.
What do we really know about the impacts on children and teenagers of social media use? The US Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy has issued a report on social media and youth mental health in which he warns of the danger of profound risk of harm. He says tech companies, policymakers and parents must all play a role in safeguarding young people. Our Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue told us what the report says about the interaction of social media and young people's development.
Well, I think it's an attempt to sort of pull together the state of current research that's out there. And it, to be fair to the Surgeon General, it says that a lot more research is needed. But it's saying that social media interacts with teenage and adolescent brains in a particular way in the development of certain parts of the brain that deal with emotional regulation and other areas like that. And he's saying that these can have damaging effects. He's also saying that, you know, there are some beneficial aspects of social media, particularly to some groups, but that really the amount of harm that can be done is substantial, and it may be contributing to mental health problems that we've seen arise in over the last decade or more.
There was one alarming line: we don't have sufficient evidence to determine social media is sufficiently safe for children and adolescents. It sounds quite alarming. Specifically, what are the concerns there?
Well, in particular things, you know, that it may exacerbate conditions, for example, like eating disorders, various kinds of body dysphoria conditions, ADHD he's also talking about, and also general sort of isolation among teenagers. I mean, some, he says that, you know, maybe up to a third of teenagers spending 3.5 hours a day glued to their screens. And of course, there are a good deal of younger children in the sort of 8 to 12 group where they're not meant to be on social media at all in terms of the regulations and the guidelines, who are using social media. And he's saying really that parents don't really have the tools to deal with this sort of landscape that's developing so quickly, and that policymakers, in other words, lawmakers and the companies, have to take much more responsibility. I mean, a lot of this is stuff that's been said over and over again by all sorts of different bodies, and the concerns have been out there for a while, but here you're getting it, you know, pretty clearly from the most senior medical officer in the administration.
And any suggestions about exactly what sorts of things the tech firms and government indeed and families can do?
More research, as I said before, also looking at ways of making sure that people or children who are under the age shouldn't be using social media. Easier said than done, of course. And some have even suggested, although the Surgeon General doesn't put a specific age on it, but he does say that he thinks 13 is too young for being allowed to join things like Instagram and Snapchat and those other different platforms that young people use, TikTok as well.
That was Gary O'Donoghue. Russia says it's now crushed one of the biggest incursions into its territory since it invaded Ukraine. Moscow says what it called a counter-terrorist operation has now defeated armed insurgents who crossed the border from Ukraine to launch attacks in Russia's Belgorod region. The Russian government insists the insurgents were Ukrainian, despite two Russian paramilitary groups claiming they carried out the attacks and Kiev denying any involvement. Here's our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
For Vladimir Putin, this was supposed to be a day of pomp and ceremony. In the Kremlin, the president presented state awards, including to soldiers who'd fought in his special military operation. But Russia's war in Ukraine has not gone to plan. He hinted as much in his speech. These are difficult times for Russia, President Putin said. It's proving a difficult week. Yesterday saw one of the largest cross-border incursions from Ukraine into Russian territory since the start of the war. The Kremlin leader made no reference to it today, but his spokesman did. Dmitry Peskov admitted that the Kremlin was deeply concerned by what had happened in Belgorod region. He blamed Ukrainian militants, though Ukraine insists it is Russian paramilitary groups that have been fighting Russian security forces there. Later, an army spokesman claimed the Russian military had routed the militants and killed dozens. There's been no independent confirmation of that. But the fact that such a large incursion happened at all, and that Russia, for a time, appeared unable to protect its border, that is deeply embarrassing for the Kremlin and for a president so keen to project his power.
That was Steve Rosenberg. Well, over the last few weeks, we have been reporting extensively on the claims and counterclaims surrounding the devastated city of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine, where intense fighting's been going on for months. But it's not the only frontline town that has been subjected to such bombardments. Some 90 kilometres southwest lies the town of Avdiivka, which Russian forces have been trying to batter into submission. Avdiivka had a pre-war population of some 30,000. Today, fewer than a tenth remain. Cut off from food and aid, local people like Ihor risk their lives every day to bring supplies in.
You might not think that a loaf of bread is heavy, but if you're bringing in 1,000 of them, then it's half a ton.
Ihor and Oleksiy are keeping the town fed and water, as we heard from the documentary filmmaker Jack Losh, who's just returned from the town.
The level of destruction in Avdiivka is hard to comprehend. This is a town that has been in the firing line from Russian forces long before last year's full-scale invasion. But the last year or so, the intensity of attacks have dramatically increased. We're talking about regular airstrikes and powerful missiles hurled into this town, this civilian town, along with a daily dose of artillery shells, of rockets. Every building is damaged or destroyed. I went to the main school there, ravaged by explosions. Entire apartment blocks caved in under these massive explosions, with bodies of the civilian inhabitants still trapped underneath. No power, no heat, no water. I spoke with one elderly lady, Ludmilla, in her basement, who she was sheltering there. And she said to me, it's getting worse and worse. I said to her, well, why don't you leave? And she said, we don't have the money to leave. We'll be homeless in other cities. We're basically homeless here. Look at my apartment. But at least we're at home.
Yeah, most of the population has left now, hasn't it? For those people who are left, people like Ludmilla, is the town receiving supplies, medical assistance? What is it like being there?
Yes, they are receiving supplies, but that operation to get them food, medicine, it is extremely dangerous and difficult. So we have a situation where the Russian army is attempting to encircle the town. They haven't been able to punch through because the fortifications are extremely strong. But as they carry out this creeping pincer movement, Ukrainian troops are battling to cling on to the fields around it. And amid this growing siege, you have two local men called Igor and Oleksiy, who I followed with my camera. And they're keeping the town's civilian holdouts alive by running in aid supplies each day. And they're the last link in a chain of international aid. These humanitarian supplies are hauled across Ukraine, but these organizations can't get it into Avdiivka because it's too dangerous. So their aid supplies are stored at a warehouse just about 20 minutes outside the town. That last leg is down to Igor and Oleksiy, who load up their old banger of a van and then run that final gauntlet to get this crucial cargo into where it's needed most.
Documentary filmmaker Jack Losh. Afghanistan remains one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters. Two-thirds of the country's population is food insecure, with almost 1 million children facing acute malnutrition. We continue to hear that women and girls remain most at risk. Aid agencies face the difficult balancing act of attempting to fulfil their responsibilities to the Afghan people by keeping aid going to those most in need, and also continuing to keep the pressure on the Taliban to end human rights violations and restrictions on women and girls. Yalda Hakim spoke to Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, who's currently in Kandahar in southern Afghanistan, and asked him about the current situation in the country.
The crisis couldn't be deeper here. As you say, 28 million people need humanitarian relief. And two things happen at the same time. Donors are withdrawing and cutting the development aid and some of the humanitarian aid at the same time as the Taliban has paralyzed much of our work because of the ban on our female colleagues. We cannot work without our female Afghan colleagues because we cannot reach Afghan females with males only. So we will not and cannot work with only with males. And I'm glad to see that there may be some movement now in getting our female colleagues back to work, back in the common cause.
Jan, I was in Kandahar about 12 months ago. I went into hospitals where children were suffering from malnutrition. There were women suffering from malnutrition. Some of the hospital staff were suffering from malnutrition. Just give us an idea of what the situation there is now, almost 2 years since the Taliban took over.
Well, it's even worse than when you were here, Yalda, a year ago. The last estimate is that there are millions of children now, breastfeeding women, that are acutely malnourished. Acutely. This happens at the same time that the World Food Program and the rest of us are flagging that rations will be further cut because of lack of funding and the lack of having females work. So it's a message both to the world. Don't turn your back on Afghanistan after NATO countries were willing to spend trillions on the failed military campaign here. But also the Taliban need to understand that unless they change, there will be a collapse in aid work here, and millions have only a humanitarian aid to rely on.
Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking from southern Afghanistan. The Secretary General of South Africa's governing African National Congress Party has warned that the country could become a failed state as repeated power cuts continue to wreak economic damage. He told Stephen Sacker on the BBC Hard Talk programme that unless dealt with decisively, the widespread power cuts threaten to hurt the ANC at next year's elections.
South Africa is undergoing challenges like many other countries. But I think to put us into a category of a failed state, it's an exaggeration. I can give.
But you think that's a conversation that South Africans are having amongst themselves?
Well, it comes from pockets of the powerful thinkers in the country who project us as displaying characteristics of a failed state, of course. We may not be too defensive to that. If certain things are not resolved, we will become a failed state. But we are not journeying towards that direction.
There are also fears that the power cuts could lead to major civil unrest in the country. Andrew Harding has been looking into the causes of South Africa's power crisis.
It is going to be a cold, dark night for many South Africans with states.
I'm driving through the very dark streets of Johannesburg. The traffic lights are all off. In fact, all the lights are off right now. The whole country is in the grip of power cuts, sometimes 8 or 10 hours a day without electricity. I've come to Alexandra, a poor township on the edge of the city, to see how people are coping.
We don't have money because of the power, because of the electricity.
This is Suzeke Musa looking out across her dark, empty bar.
Are you going to survive in your business?
I don't think so.
Essentially, this economy has ground to a halt.
This is Justice Malala, a political commentator.
We cannot provide factories, industry with electricity that's needed to produce. That has a direct impact on poor people who lose jobs. Poverty kills.
To understand what's gone wrong here, why all these power cuts, we're heading east, out of Johannesburg and into coal country. Over 80% of this country's electricity comes from burning coal.
So we're coming just to the edge of what is an illegal mine, an illegal coal mine.
A local activist who doesn't want me to use his name is showing us a so-called black site where coal is allegedly stolen and traded illegally by powerful gangs.
Even at night we hear gunshots. Even they are fighting among themselves for this coal.
The different gangs?
Yes.
The rot was much worse than I anticipated when I took the job.
This is André de Ruyter, a businessman brought in back in 2018 to lead South Africa's energy utility Eskom and to try to stop the rot. In an explosive interview with a local TV channel, the ANCA, he accused senior government officials from the ANC of being involved in the corruption.
Is Eskom a feeding trough, if you like, for the ANC?
I would say the evidence suggests that it is.
Last December, shortly after announcing his resignation, de Ruyter was poisoned at his office and later fled the country.
15-20 minutes after this cup of coffee, I started feeling extremely nauseous. And the theory is that it was a mixture of cyanide and sodium arsenite, which is a rat poison.
So what does South Africa's government make of all this? I've come to meet the Minister of Energy, Gwede Mantashe.
His doctors say he was poisoned. The tests show he was poisoned with cyanide rat poisoning.
I can't give evidence to.
So you don't recognise this picture he's portrayed of an ANC using Eskom as a feeding trough?
No.
On the streets outside, a solar installation on a sun-drenched rooftop. The irony is that South Africa could fix its energy crisis fairly quickly, as Crispian Olver from the Presidential Climate Commission explains.
We have a vast, abundant energy source freely available to us, which is our wind and solar resources. They're amongst the best of anywhere in the world. We can transition very rapidly onto a renewable dominant energy system.
And yet, for now, the power cuts are getting worse. The traffic lights still down. The corruption here seemingly overwhelming.
That was Andrew Harding in South Africa. Still to come.
It's a gaseous planet. Jupiter is gaseous all the way through, really.
So why do the stripes of Jupiter change colour?
In 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a tsunami. It triggered the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. Fukushima, a new audio drama series from the BBC World Service, tells the story of how the disaster unfolded and of those living with its aftermath.
The radiation is here. It's everywhere.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And we're back. The United States government says it will provide $245 million in aid to help support people fleeing the violence in Sudan. More than a million people have left their homes since the war between the army and the rapid support forces began 5 weeks ago. Humanitarian workers in neighbouring Chad are struggling to relocate refugees to safe areas. Meanwhile, there are encouraging signs that the latest ceasefire in Sudan is holding, despite some breaches when it came into force on Monday. So can it last? A question for our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
I think people are fairly happy that definitely the fighting is not at the same scale that it has been for the last 5 weeks or so. Yes, during the first few hours, there were reports of gunfire and even people reporting some aerial bombardment. But certainly many hours now where people are saying it's calm. This is, you know, across the capital Khartoum and Omdurman and Bari. But also we're hearing similar reports from Nyala and El Geneina in the Darfur region, where there's been a lot of fighting. So it's not completely calm, but it's certainly improved, and that's giving some kind of hope that this time it's a bit different. This is the first time that the two sides actually negotiated and signed a ceasefire agreement. So that would then allow, if things stay calm for a few days, it would allow people to have some kind of trust, either to step out of their homes and go and stock up on food. But the big thing that's needed is the distribution of humanitarian aid.
So what needs to happen now to get that aid to the people who need it?
Well, a lot of it is in Port Sudan, and it's arrived there and it's being held there, and there's all sorts of security clearances that are needed. But as far as the organisations that are supposed to move it around the country, they're going to want assurances from both sides, and they're going to want to feel sure that they're going to be safe going into areas where other armed groups and militias are operating. So it's not just the rapid support forces and the army. You know, we know that there are criminal gangs moving around Khartoum, especially looting. So that'll be a concern. But I think it would need some days before they would feel safe enough to start trying to move the aid around. But the demand is absolutely massive, with millions and millions of people who are desperately in need of humanitarian aid. And the picture was pretty grim, to be honest, before the conflict began 5 weeks ago, and it's only got worse since then.
That was Will Ross. The former US President Donald Trump has appeared in a New York court via video link to be informed by a judge that he cannot post certain evidence in his criminal case on social media. Mr. Trump denies 34 counts of falsifying business records to cover up alleged hush money paid to a porn star, Stormy Daniels, in 2016. He became the first former or sitting president to ever be charged with a crime during an historic arraignment in Manhattan in April. Richard Painter is a former chief White House ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush and is now a law professor at the University of Minnesota. Lewis Vaughan Jones asked him to explain why Donald Trump took part in Tuesday's court proceedings.
The purpose of this appearance is to explain to Donald Trump the protective order that the court is entering in this case. And what this is about is the information that the defense is provided by the prosecutor in order to assist with trial. In the United States, under the rules of civil procedure, and indeed under United States Supreme Court case law in the Brady versus Maryland case, the prosecution is required to give the defense information relevant to the case, whether it helps the prosecution or helps the defense. And this information is turned over in a process called discovery before the criminal trial. But what Donald Trump is not allowed to do is take this information, which may concern witnesses and the identity of witnesses and records on their cell phones and other materials, take this material and post it in social media where witnesses could be harassed and threatened by various extremist elements. We know all about those extremist elements out there on social media and how they helped precipitate the crisis of January 6, 2021. And so it's very common in these cases for the court to say that the prosecution must turn over the information to the defense, but the defense is not allowed to just reveal it in the public space on social media.
I see. That was really clearly laid out. Thank you for that. What would be the punishments, for example, if Donald Trump did decide to publish something?
Contempt of court. And if you're guilty of contempt of court, ignore a court order, you go to jail. That's the usual procedure. And I would think that that would happen in the case of Donald Trump. We don't have special rules for presidents and former presidents. And when a court says you do something, you do it. You obey the court. If you don't like the court order, you could appeal to the court or go to the Court of Appeals. But you don't just disobey a protective order.
That was Richard Painter. The judge said the trial of Donald Trump would begin on the 25th of March next year, meaning the proceedings are likely to start in the thick of the Republican primaries for the 2024 presidential race. In Spain, police have arrested three people in Valencia in connection with racial slurs hurled at the Real Madrid forward Vinicius Junior, who was playing for Real Madrid against Valencia on Sunday. A further four people have also been arrested on suspicion of hanging an effigy of the star off a bridge. Meanwhile, the events in Valencia are being met with outrage in Brazil. Aniele Franco is Brazil's Minister of Racial Equality. In an interview with the BBC, she Committee accused the Spanish authorities of not doing enough to tackle the problem of racism.
La Liga, every time that comes to a racist case like that, they just put in the draw and don't say anything about it, you know? And even the president and even the director of La Liga went on Twitter on the same day of the case that happened, accusing Vini Jr. of not being the victim when he was the victim on that day. So now we are asking all the ambassador of Brazil who lives in Spain, all the authorities, the governor of Spain, to investigate everything that is related to racism inside La Liga.
So it sounds as if the minister is placing the blame for the incident squarely on the Spanish Football League. Our America's regional editor is Leonardo Rocha.
That's pretty much the perception in Brazil as well. It's interesting that she's not blaming the whole of the Spanish society or the Spanish government. She says there is a problem with La Liga. Of course, many Brazilian players go there, many black kids who go there young, like Vinicius Jr., who arrived at Real Madrid 5 years ago at the age of 18. And the Lula government has been really determined to tackle racism in Spain and of course, in abroad and in Brazil. It's a big campaign issue. And, of course, this awful incident that happened on Sunday that had a great impact in Brazil, huge impact. And he more or less instructed the whole government to put pressure on Spain for real action.
So there's plenty of solidarity in Brazil with Vinicius Junior. But racism is a problem in Brazil, isn't it? And in Brazilian football.
Well, it is. The fact that we have an equalities minister, Aniele Franco, shows that there is a problem. For many years in Brazil, it's been not really mentioned. Brazil like to portray itself as a racial democracy. But there is a huge problem with racism, which usually associated with social inequality as well. So Vinicius Junior was subjected to racism in Brazil before leaving when he still played for his local club, Flamengo. And the new government has introduced new legislation, very tough legislation, and they want to work with the Spanish government and La Liga to tackle that.
Leonardo Rocha. The police in Britain have confirmed that they're investigating the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson over further potential rule breaches during the COVID pandemic. Information has been passed to two forces relating to diary entries about events at the Prime Minister's country residence, Chequers, and within Downing Street. Jonathan Blake reports.
Lawyers preparing evidence for the public inquiry into the government's response to coronavirus were given access to Boris Johnson's official diary. They raised concerns about certain entries with officials at the Cabinet Office, who in turn passed the information to police. The Times reports the entries relate to visits from family and friends. The Metropolitan Police say they're assessing the information, which relates to potential breaches of regulations between June 2020 and May 2021 at Downing Street. Thames Valley Police say they're looking into potential breaches at Chequers.
Jonathan Blake. Now, you probably have an image of what the planet Jupiter looks like. Essentially, it's striped, bands of colour swirling around like vast weather systems. But if you do look for images, you'll see that none of them are exactly the same. The stripes change colour. Well, now scientists think they know what causes the changes of colour, and they've been able to check their theory thanks to NASA's Juno craft, which has been orbiting the biggest planet in our solar system for nearly 7 years. This latest research, published in Nature Astronomy, was carried out by the maths department at Leeds University here in the UK. James Menendez has been speaking to the co-author, Professor Chris Jones. So first, what are the bands of colour around Jupiter?
Well, the different colours are basically different amounts of heat coming up from the interior of Jupiter, which affects the chemistry, basically, and then that changes the colour from light to dark. So when rising stuff comes up, it brings material up from the deep interior, and conversely, stuff from the higher levels falls down.
So it's essentially gases, is that it?
Yes, it's a gaseous planet. Jupiter is gaseous all the way through, really.
And so why are they arranged in what looks like stripes?
Because there are very fast winds going around Jupiter. The stripes are essentially at the edges of the very fast winds. And it's those winds which control the up and down movement of the atmosphere. So that they control what's coming up and what's going down, and that changes the chemistry, and then hence that changes the colour.
Yeah, am I right in saying also what is peculiar, I suppose, and different to Earth, if we think about clouds on our planet, that they move in different directions. Some move east-west, some move west-to-east. Is that right?
That's exactly right, yes. Near the equator, they're going primarily eastward. A few degrees above the equator, they're going westward. And they're fast, too, much faster than winds on Earth.
How fast, just out of interest?
100 metres a second.
Right, OK, really fast. And so let's get on to the meat of the research that you've done. Why, then, do they change colour over time?
Well, the colour is basically a signal of the heat that's coming out of the interior of Jupiter. Jupiter's slowly cooling down, and there's heat coming out from the interior all the time. And what we think is happening is that that heat flux coming out is not quite constant all the time, but has these five-year oscillations on it, which are affected by the flows going on in the deep interior, as well as the flows near the surface.
And what was it you managed to pin down? The change is what in the magnetic field of Jupiter coincided with what? The heat coming out, is that right?
Yes, exactly so. The heat coming out actually affects primarily the infrared radiation coming out of Jupiter. So the infrared radiation is detected from ground-based telescopes, actually in Mauna Kea at the top of Hawaii. And we can measure the infrared, which is the emission which is coming deepest down from Jupiter, about 50 kilometres below the surface. And we think that that heat is being supplied even deeper down than 50 kilometres down.
So now you know. Professor Chris Jones from Leeds University in Northern England. A rare wristwatch once owned by China's last emperor has sold for more than $5 million at auction in Hong Kong. Unusual features of the Patek Philippe timepiece include pink gold hands and a moon phase function. Simon Ponsford has the story.
The watch has a remarkable provenance. It belonged to Aixin Joro Puyi, the last emperor of China's Qing dynasty, whose life inspired the Oscar-winning film. He gave the watch away in 1950, on his final day at a Soviet prisoner of war camp, where he'd been held captive for 5 years. He'd been sent to Siberia after Japan's defeat in the Second World War. The Japanese had installed him as the emperor of its puppet state in northeast China. The watch was a farewell gift to his interpreter, Georgi Permakov. Bizarrely, he'd already met the emperor, a chance encounter while he was living in China as a little boy. The two struck up a close friendship at the camp, and after receiving the gift, the interpreter hid it away for some 7 decades. Now it's come up for sale in Hong Kong, and Thomas Perazzi of Philip's Auction House said afterwards it was a memorable occasion.
We have achieved 3 world records. The highest result for any Patek Philippe reference 96, the highest result for any wristwatch belonging to an emperor, and it is the highest result for any watches that Philips Asia ever sold. I'm absolutely thrilled about this auction. After 3 years of hard work and researches, we come up with a beautiful evening with outstanding results.
The watch is the latest in a series of rare timepieces once owned by other emperors to fetch dizzying prices at auction. Previous records were set by watches belonging to Haile Selassie of Ethiopia and Bao Dai of Vietnam.
That was Simon Ponsford. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, you might have heard the Happy Pod pilots we ran, and the response was such that we're making it a regular thing. Every Saturday from June the 10th, a weekly roundup of the inspiring, uplifting stuff that proves that the world isn't such a dark place after all. And we want your input. To start with, the sound of the thing that brings you joy. Email the usual address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Matthew Dean. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard. And until next time, goodbye.